This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA plus community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Saturday Magazine, sponsored by Velocity Rewards,
the award-winning loyalty program for Virgin Australia's frequent flyers.
Hey, you. Yeah, you, in the cafe. Did you know that over half of the people who listen to Joy are allies of the LGBTIQ plus community, just like you? So you may not be aware, but times are very tough financially at Joy, and we're reaching out for your support. Tell your next door neighbour, your friends, and even your dad to head over to joy.org.au and help us build Joy Nation by making a donation. Joy, your voice, your radio station.
A unique mix of world news and queer culture. Saturday Magazine. Every Saturday, 10 till 12 on Joy 94.9.
Hi, you're listening to Saturday Magazine with Tass and Janet.
Misha, welcome.
Thank you.
Great to have you back in the studio.
It's good to be back.
Happy New Year to you.
And same to you.
I did admire your new glasses. Very smart.
Thank you.
Good new look. Freshen up for the year.
Yes, a reset.
Did you manage to have a break at all?
I did. I actually spent a little bit of time in Phillip Island. But because, of course, that's Gippsland, it was incredibly smoky. Mm. And obviously, you know, with the bushfires and the bushfire coverage, there was quite a lot that we had to do sort of during that time as well because, you know, obviously there are a lot of issues that needed sort of to be explored. So it was a terrific holiday, you know, and it was sort of great to get away, but also it was a very difficult time for a lot of people, so that sort of made it a bit sort of.
I noticed right across a whole range of sectors, people's holidays were cut short. People were called back into work to actually respond in some way to bushfire recovery or relief work of some sort. So clearly, you were. I read a fair bit of the conversation over the January period.
I should say, I actually wasn't. I continued to work from Phillip Island, but I was involved a little bit in sort of, you know, putting together the coverage from where I was. I managed to avoid having to go back to Melbourne.
The conversation covered the whole issue of climate change denialism a fair bit, especially in the context of the bushfires. Shed a bit more light on some of that for us.
Well, it's actually especially important because there are certain sort of denialist memes that you see, particularly in the light of bushfires, and there's a piece by an academic who's now based in the UK, Stefan Lewandowski, that we published this week that talked about what those memes are and how you sort of inoculate yourselves against them. So there was sort of the undue focus and overestimation of the role of arson in the bushfires. There were obviously claims that, you know, we've always had bushfires. I mean, basically there's a whole bunch of things that people say to try to dismiss or minimise the link between climate change and the extreme weather that we're experiencing. And obviously, you know, over the summer it became a hugely important political issue because the really rigid denialism of the Morrison government really came into sharp relief, I think, in a way that it hadn't previously, and sort of the pressure really mounted.
But do you think it's sticking?
I do, in that I think there was a turning point moment, and with any turning point moment, obviously the caravan moves on and people focus on other things. But I do think that it has created a more difficult environment in which to be as rampantly denialist as this particular government has been. And I think it's become clear now that there's an increasing proportion of the Australian population that are becoming deeply concerned by the sort of denialist behaviour of the government. So I do think that something changed and it put increased pressure on. We haven't seen a real meaningful change in policy yet, and we may not. I mean, who knows? But I think that, you know, there is a difference.
I mean, the Prime Minister's out there loudly saying that he is acting on climate change. It is all about building more power stations. It is about clearing the forests of undergrowth and fuel. Now, you know, my sense is that argument is actually beginning to gain some traction.
Yeah, I'm not so sure. I think there's been a lot of criticism of the policy response on those grounds, that it's sort of confused and weak. There was a lot of during the course of this week, discussion about the ways in which the policy would benefit. I think it's Santos, like a major energy company, you know, key supporter of the coalition. I think there is some cynicism around this. So I don't want to overstate it, but I don't think that the policy response will go unexamined or that the debate will end here. I think that there's going to be a very serious ongoing discussion. And one of the interesting things is I was noticing in the US, one of the media outlets in the US, the Columbia Journalism Review, was writing about the media's coverage of the bushfires in Australia and was saying that media outlets tend to do a very good job of disasters. They throw resources, everyone's out in the field, they do a lot of coverage. They tend to pack up very quickly and go home.
Yes.
And while the recovery phase goes on, often the reporting sort of diminishes. I'm optimistic that's not going to happen here because the scale of what's happened is so huge. It's so widely acknowledged. And I'm seeing a lot of evidence from the media of really sort of a real genuine effort to report as communities sort of try to recover from this disaster, and also reporting the sort of policy discussions that go alongside it. So I'm optimistic that we will see, you know, a sort of a hopefully enlightened discussion.
I think we got a lot of coverage. The media, there was quite a lot of international coverage as well. Do you think that's had a bit of an impact on the way Australia's responding? I mean, in many ways, you know, I think we were shamed internationally around how little we do around the climate change and, you know, fudging the figures, all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, look, it's hard to say. I mean, again, we haven't seen a clear policy response or change from the coalition yet. And the balance within the party, within the Liberal Party in particular, in terms of the climate science denialists within that party, you know, the people who you would say sort of on the far right of this issue, if you could sort of even see it as a political issue in that way, is still the same. So I'm not sure. I guess that remains to be seen.
Parliament resumes next week. Do you think this will be a hot topic in Parliament?
I suspect that the sports rorts affair will be possibly gaining top billing just because of the way in which that particular issue is hanging in the balance now. There's a report to come that Morrison's commissioned. It's not yet resolved. There is a ministerial scalp at stake, and the theatre of Parliament loves this idea of somebody potentially about to lose their job. There's been new reports this week about more, you know, closer links between Morrison's office and the whole process. And there is a real sense of despair, I think, amongst people who follow politics closely and care about it, that any government could tough this out. Because whether or not you believe that, you know, they all do it to some extent, and perhaps there have been instances in the past, there's the famous Ross Kelly example, the brazenness with which, you know, to quote Kath Murphy from The Guardian, you know, the government used this funding like an ATM for its re-election campaign.
Yes.
Is astonishing. And if accountability of governments between elections is to mean anything, there has to be consequences, because this has been an entirely improper use of taxpayers' money. It's absolutely clear. It's clear that people have missed out. It's clear that there's been harm. And I would be very surprised if that sort of wasn't what was coming to head next week.
It seems to me that they're hoping they can tough it out. It's probably not clear whether or not they can. What will it take to provide that accountability, do you think?
I'm going to challenge that, Janet. It's been 2.5 weeks now.
It's
very, very rarely does an issue, I mean, not even climate change and the bushfires has had this much traction, really. This has been a front page story now for 2.5 weeks. It's hurting.
But wouldn't you think that if they were intending to roll, they would have done that by now to get rid of it? You know, whereas if you roll over now, then you've done 2 weeks of damage before you give in. You know, I would have thought you'd try and get rid of the agenda much sooner, especially with so much else happening.
The only thing to say about that is, I think the answer to your question is we don't know. I mean, it's obviously a political strategy question, and we don't really know. One thing that governments will do is often see how something plays, like give it time and see how much damage there is and hope that there's less than there is. Mm. So it might be that, you know, the slow dawning or the way it plays out is actually indicating, you know, the problem coming to a head. I think that One of the things from a news cycle point of view is just new information keeps something in the newspapers, and the fact that we're learning now more about Morrison's office's involvement in the process is particularly damaging. It also might make it harder to deal with, so it's sort of unclear.
But have the Australian people turned off? Are we all sick of hearing about it already, do you think?
I don't think so. I mean, there's an incredible lack of trust in politicians and in the political process. I think this is a really exemplary case where everybody can see the sort of the corruption of the handing out of grants to communities that, you know, obviously genuinely need them and, you know, something that really matters. I think it's really something that I don't think will go away. I think there is a really genuine, deep concern about this.
I agree with that. I think that what this is actually doing is deepening the mistrust that the community have in politicians, not just politicians of a particular persuasion, but all politicians. So I think this is damaging to politics full stop, not just to the government or government MPs and government ministers. So the question's just come in from one of our listeners. Why is she still on the role?
Okay,
why is she still the minister?
Well, there's a few answers to that question. I guess the most obvious answer is it's political. The government doesn't want to be damaged by having to sack a minister. That's always seen as a scalp or a sign of weakness. The second way in which it's political is because of the coalition. Removing McKenzie would create problems for the government within the National Party, so it's politically very difficult.
And deepen its gender divide.
That's right. And then the third reason that she's still in the role is that the rules around ministerial accountability are effectively policed by the Prime Minister. And the Prime Minister, is the decision-maker in this case and is somewhat implicated, obviously. You know, these actions helped get the government re-elected.
Well, that's a real indictment on the PM then.
It is, and also on the process, I guess, the idea of ministerial responsibility. The idea is supposed to be that whoever is the Prime Minister is able to sort of wear two hats, one of which is their partisan political hat, working for their party, but one of which is as a Prime Minister, as sort of a guardian of standards of the government and a guardian of the system. And I think, in a way, what we've seen in politics really over the last 15 or 20 years of increasing partisanship is people sort of really paying less regard to that role of being the guardian of the system. And I think you can really see that with Morrison's behaviour here. I mean, if you look back to the previous sports rorts affair, Ros Kelly lost their job. This one is, in many ways, more flagrant, more concerning, and yet no action has been taken. And that's a change of political culture.
I think this is deeply, deeply concerning, to be honest.
Well, it is, because it sort of thumbs its nose at the idea of accountability.
Yes.
Particularly accountability between elections.
And decency.
Yeah.
And integrity.
Integrity.
And I think we get what we put up with, don't we? So if we're if he does tough it out and we put up with that, then we can expect more.
That sets a standard. It's absolutely acceptable.
Yeah, right.
I think that's right. The other thing that Kath Murphy in The Guardian was really good at talking about was the problematic relationship between the public service and the government. I mean, it's interesting that with this whole sports rorts thing, there are clear evidences that within the relevant government departments and Sports Australia, there were concerns being raised about the authority for the minister to actually make these grants. Those concerns weren't heeded, and we have a situation where there was a report into the public service by David Thodey, which landed before Christmas. It's pretty much ignored, and Scott Morrison's approach to public service has been, we decide, you do. There's been no real sense of paying respect to the process, the expertise, the value of the bureaucrats who do things like administer sports funding programs, and you see where it ends up. So it's also about a balancing between the public servants and the political sort of masters of that process.
Michelle, we're going to take a very short break. Great conversation. We've got lots more to talk about. I'd be particularly interested in talking about the Order of Australia Awards after we get back from a short break, if you're up for that.
Definitely.
And perhaps also the, as I've now been informed, the Religious Discrimination Bill. We've decided to rebadge that and reframe the language and call it the Religious Discrimination Bill rather than the Religious Freedom Bill, because it's actually not that.
Not about freedom at all, I don't think. Now, we're going to talk a little bit about the Australia Day Awards, and I saw a bit of the ceremony. It was an interesting event.
Well, I was sort of wanting to stick on the theme of sport, so we've got our sports rorts, And then on Australia Day Awards night, there was a great game of tennis on that I was watching. And then I sort of was flicking
not
around
one
the
of
channels.
Them as well, are you tennis fans?
Well, I'm not normally a tennis fan, but during this time of year, you've got to sort of, you know, get with the program.
You're outnumbered, Taz.
Oh,
yes.
So
give
boring.
It away. Give it away.
Anyway, I was watching the tennis, and I flicked over to the Australian of the Year awards. And I've got to say, the tennis was great sport, but I thought the Australian of the Year awards were absolutely fascinating sport because basically had a situation where it was a room full of people who were trying to do a whole bunch of really good things for this country, community service, you know, people who are doing things like sort of cleaning up contaminated areas, a whole bunch of youth workers, people working with people in disadvantaged, in marginalised communities. And also
doctors, nurses.
That's right. And incredibly and interestingly, a lot of very senior academics. And from really, I mean, a couple of areas, sort of health areas and, you know, a lot of Indigenous people as well. And I just thought it was fascinating because Scott Morrison, the Prime Minister, was handing these awards to these people. And almost all of them have been advocating things for the betterment of the country, which the government isn't doing and won't do and is ruling out. So it was this sort of weird process of acknowledging these people but saying, here's your award, but we're just not going to do anything that you
so
say.
So, for example, the Australian of the Year is Dr. James Muiki.
Muiki, sure.
Who, in accepting his award, advocated a sugar tax, and the government said no.
That's right. Within 24 hours, basically just said flat no.
I thought it was within hours, actually. Yeah. So I'm surprised you even say 24 hours.
Well, he did an interview on Radio National. I think it was the next morning. But, you know, within a 24-hour time period, definitely.
Wow.
And that was very interesting. So he's an ophthalmologist who is working with people who have got eye damage, which is related to diabetes, which we know is caused by sugar consumption. He's advocating a sugar tax. And basically the minister, Greg Hunt, said, you know, we're not going to go down that track almost immediately. Now, it's interesting because there is actually compelling evidence that sugar taxes work. So why you wouldn't even have that conversation, I don't understand. Interestingly, you know, equally at the Australian of the Year Awards, you had people like Tim Flannery and other previous winners talking. You had lots of people who are winning awards who are really trying to do things about climate change and about the environment. Again, we know where the government is on that. You had a lot of Indigenous people who were talking about, you know, trying to, you know, this idea of a voice to Parliament, which, again, the government's dragging its heels on. So it's saying no to all of this stuff, which actually the experts and the people who are really in the field are advocating, and instead it's doing religious discrimination bill. And that seems to me a really interesting disconnect. And I was just really interested in sort of, you know, the fact that, you know, the Prime Minister Morrison did seem to have almost the good grace to seem faintly embarrassed by the fact he's sitting there giving the awards to all of these people who he's studiously ignoring.
So I think the reason why that occurs is because there is an independent panel that actually assesses the applications and recommends the awards. So the Prime Minister actually doesn't have any approval responsibility here. The Prime Minister's role is to actually hand out the award. So he doesn't actually get to choose whether, you know, you get an award or somebody else gets an award. If he did, it might be a very, very different story.
Well, that's right. But I think, you know, and it's true that the Australian of the Year has often been awarded to somebody who, to some extent, by advocating for particular issues, can create problems for the political leaders of the time.
Yeah, so
but
like Rosie Batty, for example.
Yeah.
And what's his name? Psychiatrist? Melbourne psychiatrist from Origin.
Oh, yes. Pat McGorry.
Professor Pat McGorry.
That's
These people have actually been very strong advocates for the work that they're doing.
And I mean, you could argue, if you wanted to be optimistic, you could say, isn't it terrific that all these people who are advocating these things do get these awards assessed by an independent panel, irrespective of whether their ideas are in favour with the government of the day or not? I mean, you could, if you wanted to be optimistic, see it that way. The way I see it is a little different is that we were talking before about this idea of declining trust. And it doesn't feel to me like there is a positive agenda for improving the country. And there is so much there in what all these people were saying that we could engage with if we were willing to listen to them.
A red herring question for you.
Yep.
Do you think these awards are past their use-by date?
I'm probably more ambivalent about and concerned about the Australia Day honours than the actual Australian of the Year awards. The Australian of the Year awards, it's got a quite a good structure in that it's there's the older Australians, you know, there's people from each state, there's the you know, sort of community service basis of them. That to me feels actually pretty good. It's more the AOs, OAMs, you know, the baubles that are handed out. They're massively complicated. You never can work out which one's which and what means what. And often
they but people get awards for doing their job.
That's right, and that's the problem. Like often it is just an award for having a good job.
I mean,
and you get a higher award the more senior you are in your job. So the more people who are doing the work underneath you.
But what's that about? I mean, why is it that, you know, ordinary folk don't have access to this?
That's right, and it's no sort of above and beyond. It's just basically people who rise to senior positions in, you know, whatever area it is, and then you sort of get your baubles. I mean, I think it's sort of appalling, really, and it's. There's a certain ugliness to it and a sort of silly parochialism to it as well.
And, of course, controversy this week with Bettina Arndt.
Well, that's right. I mean, you know...
Well, that was juicy.
And that was an interesting, you know, an interesting question.
Bit of animation around the awards this time round.
Yes, and I mean, who knows where that's going to go. You know, the idea that you can... I mean, Bettina Arndt, as I understand it, she did actually complete a degree in psychology. I think it was a master's degree. But she wasn't registered and had consistently...
I think it was in the '70s, wasn't it? As a sex therapist.
But that wasn't really the issue. The issue is that she actually had engaged in a conversation with men who were quite provocative and had a track record of
pedophilia.
Yeah, that's right. And here she is getting an award for
promoting gender. It was promoting gender equity or equality.
Oh, was it? I thought it was men's health.
Through supporting men.
It's just weird.
Yeah, fascinating.
Yeah, I mean, that is fascinating. And I do think it does actually raise a bigger, more interesting question, which is, what is the use of these awards? How do they function? You know, what is the importance of them? Because when you walk around with those, when you get the Australia, those awards.
OAMs and AMs.
Yeah.
And
they actually, you get this little pin, and you see everybody walking around with their little pins, you know. And it does provide
a bit of a club, isn't it? It's
yes.
a little bit sort of pretentious.
It is.
I'm in, you're not. I find the whole thing a little bit distasteful, to be quite honest.
I do think, though, it is important to honour people who do a lot of work in the community, and it would be great to see, you know, people who are putting in lots and lots of volunteer hours or creating conversations in our community to make our communities a better place. But I think, Taz, you're right, a lot of people do get awards for, you know...
Their job.
Doing their job well.
What about politicians? Why should politicians get an award?
Well, that's right. I mean, I think... You know, and there can be an argument where sometimes through your job you can do something that goes above and beyond and has a really big impact and makes a big difference for the community. And perhaps there's an argument in those cases. But it's just the sort of...
Well, I don't want to be partisan about this, but it's an example. Ted Bailey got an award in this round.
Yeah, you know, and I think it's interesting, I mean, because people, once they reach a certain level of prominence, it's just a matter of time. That, you know, it almost comes with the job, doesn't it? You know,
it becomes a respiratory award. You stay around and keep breathing and you'll
get
it.
You've been a premier, you've been a senior judge, you've been a senior politician, you've been a minister. You know, it might be 5 years, it might be 10 years eventually.
I mean, some of the ones that I've been particularly pleased to see, I mean, there have been some HIV activists that have had awards in the past, and David Menager, for example, John Day, both...
Jamie Gardner,
and I think that was not part of their job. They were community-based people who actually took this on and worked hard. I think they're well-deserved. But for, you know, being a good doctor or being a good nurse or being a good politician, I'm not sure about that.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think it's a really valid criticism, and I agree. I think people can sort of see it now. It's a bit, and also just the level of complexity of it too. I just think it's so elaborate and silly. You know, if you want to acknowledge somebody for their contribution to the community, great. You don't just set up all these levels of the companion of this and the thing of that.
You're not advocating a return back to the dames and knights?
Oh, no. I'm somebody who struggles to watch The Crown because I'm so hostile to the idea of us being a constitutional monarchy in the royal family.
317's just said Georgie Stone's award is beneficial, and I do agree with that one. Georgie Stone was a 15 or 16-year-old young trans person who has been advocating for trans rights and came out publicly and told their story.
It's on Neighbours now.
Yes, that's exactly right. Yeah, that's exactly right. I see that as being a very good example of how those wards could be applied, but not for being good at your job.
Yeah.
Now, let's change
the subject.
Let's
change it.
Let's change the subject slightly.
Religious discrimination bill.
Religious discrimination bill. What's happening there?
Well, perhaps you might be more up on this, on the details of this than I am. I imagine you're watching it very closely, but it just seemed to me it was very interesting this week that there was sort of the second round of consultation. It seems that at the end of the week we've got hostility from the LGBTI community, what's the group called, Equality? That's
Equality sort of, Australia.
Equality Australia, from the AMA, and basically Albanese, you know, the Labor side of politics, everybody's saying basically the bill is friendless because it is such a mess in terms of the way in which it deals with sort of rights and responsibilities. It's just, you know, I mean, it just seems to be going nowhere. And again, just, you know, for me, the question is, there are always other significant issues. Why are we doing this? Like, I still don't understand. I mean, I think we've discussed this before, but what was the case for it? What problem were we solving? I'm confused. I think a lot of the population is confused by that idea. So I don't know what your views are on what's happening with the bill, but it seems to me that the most optimistic approach you could take is saying it looks like it's just going to sort of roll along and potentially go nowhere.
Well, I think there's a view, and perhaps one I agree with, is that it's the backlash, isn't it, for marriage equality. And, you know, in other parts of the world, when we've achieved a big step forward in our rights, we've often had the pushback, and the pushback's often in the anti-discrimination space. So we might achieve the right to marry on one level, but then we can get sacked at work on the next, or we can't get denied a health service, or, you know, that's the pushback. So
I have another view about this.
Go on, Taz.
I think this is going to become one of those distractions. So when things get tough, what do? Crank out the religious discrimination bill.
It's incredibly divisive, though, and really scary. I mean, you know, we fought really, really hard for our anti-discrimination legislation, and I've worked over my years in many faith-based organisations that surrounded by really, really wonderful, wonderful people. However, sometimes the hierarchy of those organisations would be able to exercise some lawful discrimination discrimination within the law. And I think this bill will take it a whole lot further and undermine some of our state rights as well. It's one of those things that we can't win by ourselves either. I mean, it's not the gays versus the Christians. It's what kind of Australia do we want to live in?
I just can't see that there's any political upside in pursuing this. I mean, if you look at it from the point of view of the same-sex vote, the number was, what was it?
62%.
Now, if anything, that attitudes, you know, in favour of same-sex marriage would have strengthened since then considerably. So there can't be a broader electoral benefit for the government. This is about playing to a base or playing to a section.
But don't you think it also plays...
It's about dividing the community.
That's right.
It's about distracting the community from the issues that are important.
I sort of think it's a bit of a gladiator game, really. I think it's, the gays versus the Christians in the arena, fighting it out, and the rest of Australia gets to sit back and watch and enjoy.
But a fight that just doesn't even need to happen. There's not a problem to solve here.
No disagreement from this studio, Misha. No disagreement at all. Yeah. Misha, thank you for coming into the studio today. Always great to have you here. Keep up the great work with the conversation, and keep the ideas flowing.
Thank you.
Saturday Magazine is proudly sponsored by Velocity Rewards, the loyalty program of Virgin Australia.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.